Today on The Grave Talks, Nightmare Land. Lex Lonehood Nover is no stranger to the paranormal and dream states. As the web producer for Coast to Coast AM, he's heard his share of stories on the topic. Stories involving ghosts, night terrors, sleep paralysis, and more. In his new book, Lex dives deep into the world of dreams, delusional behavior among the chronically sleep-deprived, and much more. He also delves into the night terrors that occur in deep sleep, sometimes making people capable of feats that would otherwise be nearly impossible. Today, we discuss the dark and fascinating world of dreams with Lex Lonehood Nover.
Well, I think this whole subject of dreams is something that's fascinated people for eons. It certainly has for me. I've really been intrigued with the idea of lucid dreaming. So that was something I wanted to delve into and explore further in the book. But really, it was the state of sleep paralysis that kind of kicked off the idea for the whole project. This notion that you could simultaneously be experiencing, I guess, what you could call two states of consciousness at the same time, with being awake and conscious that you're in your own bedroom and your eyes are open, and yet you're having this bleed through of what's possibly your REM or rapid eye movement dream state, where your body is still paralyzed, which happens during REM, so you don't get up and start acting out your dreams. Anyway, that's the neurological explanation, that it's a kind of glitch where your body is experiencing your sleep states out of order, because you have sort of a progression every night when you go to sleep of this deeper or slow wave sleep that goes into deeper and deeper states. And then from there, you go into REM. So the explanation is that when you have sleep paralysis, it's kind of coming out of turn in this way and mixing with being awake. However, as I'm sure you probably know, there's a lot of paranormal and different supernatural lore that has built up over time and across cultures or around this experience. So what I tried to do was consider both of these in kind of equal footing and look to not kind of cancel each other out, but look at both of them as parallel tracks for this kind of experience. And then from there, I got into things like hypnagogia, which is the state just before you fall asleep. And I included it kind of an umbrella term to also include when you're first waking up from a dream. So that kind of borderland state seems to have a lot of interesting experiences associated with it as well.
With sleep paralysis, let me ask you this. Have you personally ever experienced that state?
I've had two experiences of it that were pretty definite that, okay, the first time I had it, I didn't know what it was. And so that actually, I think, is more terrifying in a way. I've had more subtle states where your body, it feels like you're partially paralyzed and then you're coming out of it. So I think with a lot of these things, there's gradations. Similarly, with lucid dreaming, there's these sort of sublucid states and partial lucidity moving to more complete lucidity. Whereas, yeah, sleep paralysis, I think, is utterly terrifying, even if you know what it is, particularly if you're seeing one of these malevolent entities, which I did in one case. What about you, Tony? Have you had the experience?
I did. It was years ago, and I've talked about this on the air before, where I sat up in bed, and this is what is weird to me about it, is that occurred. There was a physical initial movement on my part where I sat up, but then I could not move. Then I was paralyzed. And what happened was it felt as if a cloud moved through me. That's the only way I can kind of explain what it felt like. And it was almost kind of a chattering, shaky, feel. And I have no idea what that was. I was thinking paranormal at the time. I didn't know anything about sleep paralysis. This was 2001 when this happened. And it scared the crap out of me. I had been hearing ghost stories about this area where I lived in this apartment and this area in Wisconsin in a city called Wausau. And right behind the wall of where my apartment bedroom was a stairwell that had ghost stories attached to it, where people would see the apparition of a woman carrying a baby up and down. That sort of a lore going on. So I immediately connected it to that sort of a thing. Maybe it has something to do with this ghost story. But it was terrifying. I went in and talked to a paranormal investigator named Chad Lewis shortly after, because he was in the area, and asked him about it. And that's where I first learned about sleep paralysis. And all signs seemed to point to that's what it was. I did not open my eyes during the experience. Maybe I should have. I don't know. It would have been even more terrifying. But the feeling was unlike anything I'd ever had, of just not being able to move and feeling as if, something is dark and something is around me. So I like to think it was sleep paralysis. The jury, I guess, is still somewhat out on it, but nowhere near terrifying or as terrifying as some of the stories that we've had on the show. What was your experience when you first had it specifically?
Well, the more recent one I thought was kind of funny, because it was in the late 90s when I was listening to Art Bell. Mm-hmm. And so I actually dozed off while listening to the program, and during the paralysis episode, I could still hear him talking. He was doing a commercial for Sea Crane Radio, so there was this very kind of innocuous backdrop. But I saw this male entity that was kind of almost like a spider in a web in the corner of the ceiling, just looking at me very malevolently. This was around 1999. So at that point, I did know what sleep paralysis was. And even so, it just is such a bizarre experience to have your eyes open to see this very palpable figure that just has this like murderous expression on their face. And yet you're in your bedroom. And as I mentioned, I was hearing this radio show, which I thought was particularly kind of funny or ironic, because, you know, here's a show that's about all this strange paranormal stuff. And I think it helped that I did know what it was. So even though it's still terrifying, I think when you can identify it, then it gives you a chance to not completely freak out about it.
Yeah, to put a little more context to it, it is certainly helpful. And I know it helped me after I talked to some folks about it. And at least that's the story I like to tell myself. As I go back and I revisit that story from time to time, as others recount theirs, there seems to be variance to sleep paralysis as far as what goes on physically around us. I had mentioned what stood out as odd to me was the fact that I initially did move and then I was paralyzed. But I hear stories like that all the time as well, where people are either coming out of sleep, they're going into sleep, but they somehow get stuck in that state of being right between awake and asleep, as you were describing more scientifically, more eloquently earlier. I the way that I kind of like to look at it, and sometimes I explain, do you remember color forms as kids, where you would have the scene and then you take the sticky figures and then stick them onto the scene and then it populates whatever you're doing? Mm-hmm. That's what I like to kind of explain it as. So you have the scene, you open your eyes and there's your room. But then the color forms you stick on there, and they're really not physically part of the environment, but they can be stuck there. That's kind of what our mind, I think, does during sleep paralysis, when it is just an authentic situation of your mind interjecting these images onto our reality when trying to explain it to someone who's never had it before. But that's the interesting thing, though. We have cases like that where it is seemingly in our minds, and we have the occurrence. We wake up, our physical environment has not changed. There's nothing about it that has been altered due to the experience. But there are certainly cases and stories where it seems what interaction had happened during the sleep paralysis episode actually does influence the environment. Things moving off of dressers, things in the room being misplaced that we did not do before we went to bed, but seemingly we have memories of this when we were in that state before we snapped out of it. What are your thoughts on situations like that when that is presented?
Well, I was going to mention before when you were talking about your experience in a home that was possibly haunted, mm-hmm. I ran across a fair amount of research connecting sleep paralysis to places that did have hauntings or poltergeist activity. There was a bigger likelihood of people having nightmares and paralysis and kind of malevolent or negative activities that would occur during the sleep and dreams period. So it does seem like there's a connection between these types of occurrences. It's hard to pin it down exactly as to what might be, say, just a neurological glitch as opposed to some kind of psychic entity or paraphysical being that's visiting us or kind of feeding on our energy. There were a number of cases where people would wake up into sleep paralysis and see this figure that was already sort of laying on them or attached to them, and the figure would be surprised to see them suddenly be awake as if they were kind of there doing whatever it is that they were doing and were just kind of thought they had carte blanche to do whatever they wanted while this person was asleep. And so it kind of suggests this idea of almost this like hidden ecosystem that perhaps there's things going on in our sleep that we're not aware of. In the book, I kind of compare it to this idea of like dust mites that are in our beds and kind of, you know, eat our dead skin and are just sort of happily coexisting with us. We don't even see them. So it's an interesting thing to ponder. What if there are these astral entities or some kind of beings that exist in a parallel or invisible dimension to ours, but at times there's almost like a portal where we connect with them in these cases, perhaps of sleep paralysis, where we're able to kind of catch on to these things. And whether it's a parasitic kind of interaction where they're just kind of feeding off of our energy and draining us, which is part of the whole vampire lore, or perhaps I wondered if it's maybe a kind of symbiosis that maybe in some ways this isn't a bad thing for us. It's just part of like a food chain or some kind of greater ecosystem that we aren't even aware of because we just perceive things through our six senses.
Yeah. It's almost like, is it tapping into another frequency that we're not able to pick up in our waking hours? And are we then tapping into that and seeing this reality that otherwise we could not be picking up on? And then if that's the case, are all sleep paralysis experiences somewhat, or do they dive deeper into the world of paranormal and supernatural and go beyond just psychological?
It's mind-boggling to kind of extract. And I think it could vary. In one case, it might be just more clearly some kind of neurological hallucination. Other cases, maybe there is more of this kind of paranormal interaction.
Yeah.
One thing that fascinated me, it was kind of a new discovery for me, was because I thought, okay, there's these three main states of consciousness. There's when we're awake, there's when we're dreaming, the REM dreaming, and then there's sleep, this deep sleep or slow wave sleep, they call it, related to the brain waves. And while that's true, I guess I thought that during the slow or deep wave sleep, we're we're just out. That's it. You know, we're not, there's no content. But actually what I found is there's always content going on in the brain. And so during these deeper types of sleep, there's stories going on there. There are things that are happening. We just have almost zero recall of it. So that really made me wonder, in terms of this idea of this hidden ecosystem, if there were sorts of interactions that were happening during that portion of sleep, we would really have almost no recall of it whatsoever. And I guess I got thinking about that whole level of sleep because I was exploring what's called parasomnias, which are different sleep disorders, I guess you could call them, these physical or emotional abnormal occurrences that accompany sleep and dreams. And a lot of that activity, sleepwalking is a classic example, those are all occurring during this slow wave sleep. So if someone is up and sleepwalking, there's content going on in their mind, they're thinking about things, but again, they have almost no memory of it. So that really fascinated me, this idea that there's this storyline or narrative, even though it might be a lot simpler than in the REM dreams, that there's always this content, but we have almost no memory of it.
Something before we move off of the topic of sleep paralysis, a very common thing that we hear, and I think the first person I ever heard about it from years ago was Art Bell, would be the old hag syndrome. When you're in the sleep paralysis state, the first few times I had really heard about it in depth was that you open your eyes and a common thing that is seen is the old hag, this old, decrepit, scary-looking woman that's sitting on you, and that's what seems to be a very, like I said, a very frequent occurrence with sleep paralysis. Not certainly by any means every occurrence, but many do have this. What I've always found interesting about sleep paralysis is the fact of that being a common occurrence. If we're all in this sleep paralysis state and having different sleep paralysis experiences, why is it then, if this is a mental thing, that our minds generate this same experience over and over? Why would for some it not be an elephant? Why would for some it would not be, insert object here that our mind is projecting on us for this pressure that we're feeling? Why is it, do you think, that for so many or a large piece of this pie, it is the old hag that is experienced in sleep paralysis?
Well, interestingly, these different forms take different shapes and identities across different cultures. So the old hag seems to be a popular term in North America, but there are all sorts of different descriptions in different parts of the world. Like in Germany, for instance, they talk about an Alp, a demonic being or elf that attacks and paralyzes people in their sleep, and they call it Alpdrücke or elf pressure. And this being is said to enter through the keyhole of a bedroom. And in Japan, it's called Kanashibari. It's depicted in folktales as kind of a magical power that monks use to immobilize people and animals. I personally think that what people experience in sleep paralysis is very unique and idiosyncratic. So while they may see something that looks like an old hag, one person's old hag may be quite different than another's. So I think there's a lot of variation in contrast to, say, something like the alien abduction syndrome, which I look at in the book in terms of these bedroom encounters. And that to me really did seem different than sleep paralysis, because people really were describing these very repetitive and similar beings and experiences in terms of this medical testing. Whereas the descriptions I've read about and heard that people have during sleep paralysis seem pretty unique and different, even if there are people that say, oh, yeah, it was the old hag. But like I mentioned, it seemed like there's quite a bit of variation to what that might actually present itself as.
Yeah, you're exactly right. The more I hear stories about sleep paralysis, the more frequently I hear other variations, well beyond just an old hag. It just seemed that if you were to take the pie of, you know, that would have a big piece of that pie of what people seem to experience on a similar level. Another thing that we hear quite a bit about with sleep paralysis is shadow people. Seeing these shadow-like forms. You had mentioned a shadow-like spider creature that you had experienced in your room. Let's talk about that a little bit and some of the experiences with shadow people that people will account for experiencing in sleep paralysis, but then even in the waking hours in that very same house. Is it so much paralysis? Are the two seemingly connected at times when there is a true haunting going on in a house?
Well, one thing I've noticed in terms of the stories that I've heard on Coast to Coast over the years, or just when people are recounting different experiences, say with shadow people or ghostly entities, these are often associated with when they're laying in bed. So it could be part of what I was talking about before with this half sleep or hypnagogic state, where that is when they perhaps have a window into this other world and can see entities or interact with them that they might not be able to do during their waking state because their consciousness is occupied with just going about their daily activities. The whole shadow people thing is very interesting because it feels sort of like a new variation on ghosts. And it's something that's really fascinated me because there certainly are cases of it where people see these kinds of images in their peripheral vision when they're wide awake. So that could be kind of a different phylum or something more like a typical ghost encounter. Although for what I researched, I was really looking at a lot of these encounters that are associated with the dream and sleep state. For instance, what they call these crisis apparitions, where someone, say, suddenly they're laying in bed and they see their ill grandmother appears to them and has some kind of message. And I hear a lot of stories like that. Different variations of it, but these similar things where a beloved relative appears and then they find out the next day that that's around the time that they died. So almost always those cases seem to be when the person is laying in bed. So, or in a lot of those cases. So it does make you wonder if there is this almost kind of special form of communication that is tied into this mixed brain state that we experience when we're closer to the dream and sleep state. The other thing about shadow people that's interesting to consider is this whole kind of creepy pasta thing that's been born in the internet age, where it seems like these kind of mythical beings like Slender Man start to get talked about and kind of built up in identity. And then it's almost like this conjuring that people are manifesting these things that they've read about. So that makes me suspect that maybe there's an element of when people start to get obsessed and really involved in different beings of this nature, perhaps there's a part of the brain that can form these things, almost like these etheric bodies. Have you run across that in some of your shows?
The Slender Man, where it seems something out of lore that was manufactured by a creative mind, and then somehow it's kind of coming into reality. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think at times that is out there, and that's a whole. It's funny, the bigger the deeper we go down this rabbit hole, the more questions we all have as to where, you know, where does this begin? Is this something where our minds are able to do that? Where we are essentially creating basically our fears coming to life in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself is a very scary proposition. When it comes to sleepwalking, that's a whole other area. And there can be just the innocent, you know, I got up out of bed and I walked down the stairs and saw mom and dad watching TV as a child. And they told me to go back to bed and I went back to bed. And then sometimes you have people that seem to go on missions of sorts when they're sleepwalking, whether they're walking to a certain destination that they somehow have in their mind that they need to get to, or there's a task that they need to perform. And then even sometimes they're on a mission of some sort for something that they couldn't really even speak to or have knowledge of, or that we're aware they had knowledge of in their waking state. But somehow in that dreamlike state, they were going someplace for some reason, and they don't really know why. Let's talk about some of the odd and depths of sleepwalking that you've uncovered in your research for the book.
Sure. I think that people feel a sense of embarrassment or shame around a lot of these parasomnias because they're getting up and doing things that they have no conscious awareness or control over. So that seemed to be a recurring theme to a lot of these things that I think people in years past kept hidden and didn't talk about. And now there's been the growth of all these sleep clinics across North America and the world. And with the internet, people are able to sort of look up things. Like when you were saying about these missions that people go on when they're asleep, one of the classic things is sleep eating. And that actually affects about 1% of the population. So it's not really that rare when you consider how many people there are. And so I actually had a friend that did that. And one night a friend and I were at his place, and he had taken an Ambien and gone to bed. Some of these sleep medications can be triggers for sleepwalking and sleep eating, which I think that was the case in this incident. But we were sitting up having some wine, and all of a sudden he comes out into the kitchen and opens up a cupboard and tears open this bag of corn chips and proceeds to just dump them all into the stainless sink. And then he just starts like eating them out of the sink. So his niece Barbara says, like, "Oh, are you? Did you want a plate for those?" And he just kind of makes this sort of grunting sound, and so we kind of go over to, you know, investigate and see if he's okay. And so I said, "Oh, you know, are you okay?" And he just goes, you know, it was almost like this kind of subhuman type person that was just functioning at this very like base kind of level of existence. And it just seemed like his whole demeanor and goal was just to simply eat these corn chips and then go back to bed. And he later, when we told him about the next day, he said that, yeah, sometimes he would wake up the next day and find these empty pints of ice cream. Or one time he even had used these cans of sardines that he'd opened and then had used them in these art books as like bookmarks, kind of trashing these really expensive books. So this whole issue of sleep eating, it can be more problematic than some of the other parasomnias because people might be gaining weight in their sleep or just eating a lot of noxious things, or sometimes they'll just be these giant messes of, you know, like jelly on the refrigerator door and trails of food leading back to the bed or in the bed. And it can even be dangerous when people like leave the oven on, or Montel Williams, the TV host, actually is one of the more well-known people that talked about having the problem. And he had to stop keeping meat in his house because he would, when he would wake up the next day, he'd find like bite marks inside like frozen meat and things of that nature, where you can even like damage your teeth. Mm-hmm. One of the funny things about sleep eating is that no one ever seems to make a healthy salad. It's always these kind of carb type meals or things that you can just eat quickly, like the tortilla chips. Although sometimes people eat really bizarre things. Like there was a case where a woman made a sandwich out of cat food, and apparently she was just about to like bite into it and then decided not to. And it wasn't from her memory, she had some memory of this. It wasn't because she suddenly realized, oh, this is cat food. I don't want to eat that. It was because she simply decided, oh, I don't feel like a cat food sandwich right now.
And it's just completely reasonable at that moment in time. Our mind is in such a state where whatever our dreams are telling us is what it is. That's it. It's a very, I understand that. I understand that because I will have dreams sometimes where it's like I'm in a completely alternate reality of my life. I have kids. I have a wife. Sometimes I'll have a dream where they simply don't exist and I have no recollection. I have no memory of them. It's almost as if I have transported myself to my a version of me from 15 years ago where I had never met these people and I'm just doing what I'm doing. And in your mind, you'll think of what you were thinking about back then of, oh, someday, someday I'll have this, someday I'll have that. And I'll wake from those dreams and I'll be like, how bizarre. This was just 5 minutes ago in my dream. I'm thinking in this state as if it is reality of how it was all these years ago of what, you know, what's going to be someday. But I couldn't pull up that I have kids. I have a wife. I have a house here. I'm living in this city. And it's just gone. Completely gone. And you can go in these dream states for hours on end about whatever seems to be the setting for the dream, working the job you've never worked or whatever it may be. And it's just completely logical. And sometimes I find I'll have memories within the dream of these workplaces or these cities that I'm working in or visiting I remember being here a couple years ago and this happened over there. And these are places that don't exist. Sometimes they're people that don't exist aside from the dream. And then I have to wonder, well, sometimes in these dreams, maybe I did do that in a previous dream. Maybe this is almost like a soap opera and a drama that's running somewhere in my subconscious that these events did occur. And I am literally recalling a memory or an event that I'm referencing from years past, but all these things only occurred in the dream state.
Yeah, the subject of memory is really fascinating when it comes to dreams. Like you were saying, I've experienced that where it's almost like a separate memory track where in the dream state you have people and places that are familiar to you, but only in the dream state. And it's said that during REM sleep, as well as these sleepwalking episodes when you're having the non-REM sleep, that the parts of the neocortex, the more modern evolved part of the brain that governs rational thought and memory, is dampened down or turned off. So that's why it seems like we don't have access to our full memory. But it's very odd in that some dreams you may be aware of things that relate to your current life and other ones not so much or not at all. So it really is kind of a grab bag of states that can vary a great deal. And that's why when people ask about, oh, well, what do dreams mean, or just these larger questions about their significance, it really strikes me that dreams are not one size fits all. They can really run the gamut between just some kind of mindless, repetitive thing that has very little meaning to something very powerful that could be life-changing, or, you know, some amazing allegory or symbolic kind of thing. So they, I think, like our own life experiences, they really can be any number of things.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Lex Lonehood-Nover on dream states. Be sure to check out his book, Nightmareland, available wherever books are sold. In part two of our interview, available for Gravekeepers exclusively at patreon.com/thegravetalks, we will ask him, how does lucid dreaming put us closer to deceased loved ones, enabling us to get messages from the grave? How and why is it that people can have dreams that seem to foretell a future event? What kind of horrific events have occurred that have been blamed on sleepwalking? Did a man get away with murder because of a nightmare state that he was acting out through sleepwalking? And is this all in our head? Or is there something else using our body as vessels for their own intentions? All of that and more in part two of our interview. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.